All right, folks, so it's 1 minute, 1 minute after. I'm just going to kind of jump in here. More people might be showing up, and I don't know how sizable the group is. That's one of the problems with lecturing through a phone, is you can't see how full the room is. But I'm not going to put everyone on mute, just simply because it sounds fine right now. If you know there's going to be background noise, or if you get kind of feedback or whatever, just be kind of responsible, put yourself on mute there. So this is great. Hello, everybody. I think we've got kind of a small group here, so when we open it up for question and answer, I think it can get pretty pretty interactive. So we've only got an hour, and I'm a talker, and I'm sure a lot of us in the line are talkers as well. So this first call is really just going to be kind of setting the stage, and I want to give you a sense of the way I run these calls moving forward and kind of my broad goals for even getting involved with this this project or this second publicity offering. But ultimately, you know, just to kind of foreshadow, I do want this to be an interactive thing. This first call may be a little bit more lectury, I'm going to kind of give you guys a homework assignment, as it were, which will make the next call much more open and participatory. Let's just jump in. So I'm Zach, and I don't know exactly who's on the call, how many people know me, so I'm just going to kind of give my standard introductory spiel. I'm a doctoral student at Harvard. I'm studying cognitive developmental psychology, philosophy, education. So I'm kind of just a philosopher of education. In the academy, I do a lot of work in the field of mind, brain, and education. There we kind of focus on, at least I focus on, philosophical issues tied up with this emerging field of educational neuroscience. In particular, I'm worried about psychopharmacology. So I'm kind of counteracting flatland in the academy in this field of mind-brain education, calling for a comprehensive approach to issues of education. But I also am deputy director of the Developmental Testing Service, which is a nonprofit geared towards standardized test reform in K-12 education, and then also adult assessment in large organizations or coaching and psychotherapy contexts. And so the work I do there is basically working in cognitive developmental psychology, and we are, to use kind of integral parlance, we're operationalizing Altitude to change the standardized testing infrastructure for K-12 education to move from kind of arbitrary IQ-type assessments towards actual developmental assessments in teaching and learning. In both those areas, kind of in the academy and in this kind of education reform world, I'm consistently using kind of philosophical and meta-theoretical lenses that are roughly coterminous with integral theory. I started out as a Wilberian, just dyed in the wool. I was a musician, and then I started reading Wilber, and then the rest is history as far as that goes. And this is where it starts to get relevant to this theme of second simplicity that Mark raised on the first call. I had a period of engagement with Wilber where I just simply bought it in a very simple way. And I learned all the terminology and kind of had a really nice working model, and everything got simple. But then as I started to read through into Wilber's footnotes and to follow up through his bibliography, all of a sudden some of those constructs that were once simple kind of became really complex. And actually, I pushed back against them, and I started to question them, and started to see all the counter arguments, started to see all the nuances in a concept. For example, just like levels of development, right? So it went from being simple to being complex. And then after a couple of years of kind of like holding Wilber at arm's length, someone's got to put themselves on mute there. Yeah, great. As I was saying, you know, I held Wilber at arm's length. I compared his meta theory to at least six other large-scale philosophical undertakings, Peirce and Kant and Hegel. And so what was once simple, just kind of a simple Wilber position, became this very complex, nuanced position. And for a while there, I didn't know exactly, for example, how to engage in a language game around education without using the spiral dynamics vocabulary and the four quadrants model and all of this integral language. But slowly I was able to transition towards a new way of using language, right? I talk about making integral moves in non-integral language games, right? And I see that as one of these transitions from simplicity to complexity and then back to simplicity, to a second simplicity on the other side of complexity. So one of the things I want to do on these calls is actually, as an educationist, I want to help people who are very fluent with integral theory move through something like that transition to complexify some of the basic concepts of integral theory, especially the developmental ones, and then to come to find a way to rearticulate them in a new language, possibly one that's more digestible to broader audiences. So that's kind of one goal I want to do here. But the other goal is also to talk about this dialectic, the move from simplicity to complexity and then back to simplicity to a second simplicity, because it's actually one of the basic developmental mechanisms that's been on developmentalists' radar since before there was psychology. You know, it's one of the ways of characterizing Hegel's dialectic, for example. But it shows up early with James Martin Falls through Piaget, Kohlberg, Fisher, and Wilbur, if you look at Spectrum of Consciousness, for example, or Transformations of Consciousness, two of Wilbur's kind of earlier works. He identifies this fulcrum mechanism, the move from the one to the many, and then back to the one, differentiation and hierarchical integration, basic developmental mechanisms. So I also want to talk about that and the way it shows up, especially in the so-called second tier. Because that's one place where, and of course, you know, the concept of second tier is one that we want to problematize, right? But there is something going on in the move from into the post-formal levels, post-formal operational forms of cognition, post-conventional forms of morality, autonomous or integrated forms of self, all of these things that happen roughly at that higher stages of human development. One way of characterizing that, and the one way it's been characterized in the literature, is as a move from just being mired in complexity to all of a sudden finding this new type of simplicity, finding this new, more general, more organized and integrative kind of way of making sense of yourself and of the world. I think that's an important developmental transition, which on the micro scale, kind of in the upper left quadrant, many people are navigating in our culture as a result of our, you know, pretty remarkable educational opportunities that are available. We're actually getting up to those levels, and people are trying to transition out of a kind of fragmented, kind of fractured identity with multiple roles conflicting into some kind of unified kind of self with a single but more abstract orienting framework. So on a micro scale, that's a transition we're making quite a bit in our culture. As someone who deals a lot with higher education and looking at student populations in higher education, especially with these, you know, Gen X, Gen Y folks, like that's a major issue of identity development. So I kind of want that's going to be a theme that comes up in my breakout calls. But on the on the macro scale, right, so it's happening to individuals, but I also think it's happening in the culture at large. I think as a culture, we're trying to find that second, and as a culture, we're trying to find narratives that weave unity out of the diversity. And so that's something that's also very interesting. You know, one way I think to think through what Wilbur has brought to the table is that meta-narrative, a single coherent narrative that unites a bunch of different kind of strands or fragments of culture. So that's another theme that'll come through. So we'll work for the second simplicity as a micro for the individual and try to talk about, you know, what are those emergent forms of sense-making and self-making. But then we also want to talk about the move to second simplicity of the macro. And what would some kind of broad, unified social narrative look like in this postmodern culture, right? So, for example, if you were trying to organize a coherent narrative for my generation, right, people who are between, you know, 25 and 35, like what would that coherent social narrative look like, given that this is kind of an age of fracture? This is an age of complexity, right? An age that's pushed back against the simple kind of narratives of the post-war America, or even the simple narrative that our parents gave us, right? So those are some of the ways that I frame the issue of second sensitivity. So those are two broad goals. But I think the real goal here is actually, at least my interest in teaching the class is to learn from you guys. The kind of one thing I've learned through years of teaching is that if you structure a class right, it's actually tremendously rewarding for the instructor. So the way I want to work these calls is to have you guys bring problems or topics, right, under those broad headings I just outlined. So, for example, we can talk about just one of Wilbur's constructs, right? So, for example, we could talk about this idea of growth to goodness, or we could talk about this idea of value memes and the spiral dynamics model, right? So there's a variety of Wilberian constructs that we could put on the table and then move through the second simplicity, right, kind of process or dialectic. So we could just look at it, what does Wilbur say, and then we could say, how is this actually not as simple as Wilbur makes it? What are all the complexities and caveats that could be issued around, for example, developmental level as a construct? And then once we've pushed through all the complexity and we have all the caveats in hand, how do we then talk about it in a simple way that gets traction? So that's one thing I think we can do. And I don't want to supply those constructs. I want you guys to bring them up. I've got ideas in mind in case no one knows, but I'm sure you guys have your favorite Wilberian constructs you'd like to kick around for a while. And the other issue is that of the second simplicity on the micro and on the macro. And so we can bring up issues in our lives or issues that we're seeing in the culture and try to find, like I'm suggesting, these new ways of putting language to them, right? Beyond the just simple everyday integral analysis, which I think a lot of us are getting bored of. But how do we kind of make those same insights, but in ways maybe where the language is more revealing, less confusing to people outside of integral circles, right? It gives you a little bit more traction. So that's another thing I want to work on. So that's the broad frame of how I want to run the breakout groups. And so my suggestion would be that we can get going down that path right now today, and you guys can bring up questions, or I could just kind of take the lead and work through a couple of Wilbur's constructs that I think are particularly amenable to this type of analysis. And then if you guys didn't want to get into it now, you could send me emails, for example. I'm willing to throw my email out at the end of the call. You could email me suggestions for the next breakout call, big picture topic type stuff. So that's kind of my initial spiel, my initial frame. So now what I want to do is kind of open it up, get some reflection back from you guys, kind of how did that sound? Does that make sense? And, where should we go from here? So what do you think?
Ken, it's Sasha here from Tasmania, Australia. Look, thank you. I'm really fascinated and interested in engaging in this process and communication. But unfortunately, I'm just brand new to the whole site, and I've been very fortunate to pick up on being able to belong or become part of this part of the training in second simplicity. But I'm a little bit familiar with what you're saying about Ken Wilbur, but I actually haven't read Ken Wilbur or had information or instruction on his background more than last week's seminar. So if you could expand on some of those constructs, I'd be really grateful, because I feel like I'd love to come in and communicate on some of the things we've discussed, but I actually don't have Ken Wilbur's constructs in place. So could you enlighten us a little bit more on that?
Yeah, no, I can definitely give a kind of a quick overview of integral theory. So, that probably is the place to start, huh? Just kind of to make sure we're all on the same page. I can even step back and put it in context and actually demonstrate what I mean by kind of complexifying our ways of characterizing Wilbur. So if you put Wilbur in historical context, you see that Wilbur emerged in a particular kind of intellectual epoch in American ideas. So there was a time after the Second World War when some of the most important psychoanalytic theorists and some of the most important cultural and social philosophers migrated from Europe I ended in New York City and on the West Coast. And so what emerged from that was a distinctly American brand of kind of depth psychology and psychotherapy. And it started to mingle with the unique and multitudinous forms of American religiosity that were also flourishing in kind of post-war America, especially the influx of Eastern religions. So in the early 70s, Wilbur started to imbibe this kind of ecology of ideas that he was surrounded by. He was able to, for example, in Lincoln, Nebraska, where he wrote his first book, to buy copious amounts of published material through the mail, which was something that was kind of unique to that time in American history. But not just any old books, the first translated Buddhist sutras to be, you know, kind of mass distributed. Wilbur was really one of the first great East-West synthesizers after Alan Watts, let's say. His first book, what he wrote when he was 21, kind of launched a career where he would become known as the Einstein of consciousness, and it was, of course, extremely impressive. And to this day, stands as one of the better intellectual offerings of the past 30 or 40 years. So his first books were primarily about integrating Western models of psychology, specifically developmental models, or Piaget and Kohlberg, with Eastern models of, let's just call it, spiritual attainment or awakening. And what's interesting in his early work is that all he's interested in is what I call the micro. All he's interested in, how does an individual go from the cradle to becoming a mature, autonomous ego, to then transcending that ego and seeing that the ego is actually a part of a much larger surround, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his first books were that. His first books were laying out this developmental spectrum. Right, he called it. And he wrote several books along those lines, unpacking individual development and then unpacking sociocultural development. And then, to make a long story short, he gained and then lost a wife to breast cancer, reoriented some of his theorizing, and came out with this massive magnum opus called Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. And it's in that book that he laid out what's called the four-quadrant model. So I'm not sure if that terminology is familiar to you, but most people associate Wilbur now with the four-quadrant model. And I think a simple way to break down the four-quadrant model is just that it's the, and this is classical integral parlance, it's the inside and the outside of exteriors and interiors. So another way to break it down is first person, second person, third person perspectives, or I, we, and it. And so the idea here is that these are the most primordial distinctions that can be made when considering the world. There's the first person, and then there's other people, and then there are objects.
Mm-hmm.
And out of those most basic primordial kind of constructs, or kind of that's where nature gets carved at the joints, out of those arise the methodologies that we consider scientific. So the four-quadrant model is basically a set of meta-theoretical constructs to both organize the phenomenology of our experience, but also to organize the disciplines, the special disciplines that populate the academy. Right? So the four-quadrant model is a very simple thing because it breaks down in terms of I, we, it, and it. But it's also very complicated as far as it plays out what I say. It's a discourse regulative role. So Wilbur's trying to organize the sciences. Wilbur's trying to make sense of the scattered array of academic disciplines and somehow draw a unified language from it. Right? So that's one way of characterizing his work in terms of the four-quadrant model. But, of course, in Sex, Ecology, Spirituality, he also ties in all of his prior writing on the deeply kind of religious strains of human transformation that need to be facilitated through structures in all four quadrants. So, you know, I'm not giving your standard aqual account here. I'm trying to demonstrate that there are multiple ways of giving narratives about Wilbur. That's just kind of a common are for the people who know Wilbur. So my suggestion would be, as far as kind of getting up to speed for future calls, you know, would be there are quite a few good introductions to integral theory out there that are freely available on the web. The Second Simplicity course is offered through Core Integral, which, you know, my dear friend Clint, you know, he's built some of the best kind of e-learnings, you know, so if you don't want to read, you know, whatever it was, 800 pages of psychology spirituality, you can get some of these e-learnings that Clint's done, which lays out the same conceptual frame. But, you know, that's not, you can't do justice to Wilbur even in an hour, but
I
hope that that was, you know,
enough. It has actually, and I did listen to a series or a seminar on the quadrants, so I do have that basic understanding. I just wanted to understand the perspective that you're plugging into, because I don't have a lot of background, obviously, just this initial kind of introduction, but thank you for that. I don't know if anyone else has any questions like that.
Yeah, are there any other questions?
Hey, Clint,
any questions on that characterization of Wilbur?
Was someone asking a question? I'm sorry. I didn't.
No, you're good.
I said Clint, but I meant Zach. I remember what call I'm on. This is John. I actually just was kind of trying to find an introductory summary of Wilbur to share with some people, and I found an article that I thought was really concise and gets a lot of concepts in a short reading that, I'm sorry, I forget the woman's name who was speaking.
Sasha?
So this is online at, I don't know if you wanted to write it down, but it's called an Integral Theory of Consciousness. And I don't know, Zach, you know, your opinion on that article. It's a short article. It says it's from the Journal of Consciousness Studies. And it's a very quick, you know, it's a pretty quick, easy read that just puts a lot of stuff down very neatly. So that might be a good place to start reading, too.
So where do I find that?
I'm actually in front of my computer, so I could give you the web address. It's www.imprint.co.uk/Wilbur.htm. Do you get that?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I sent it out to some friends who I was wanting to share this with because I thought it was a very, very nice read.
Thank you very much, John.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good one. That is a good overview, the one from Journal of Consciousness Studies. So, yeah, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to say my email now because I have a PDF of that. And I have a PDF of quite a few of the other things we may be mentioning. So I want everyone to have my email as well so that we can really exchange documents and kind of build knowledge together here collectively. So the email I'd like you to use is stein@gmail.com. And so, you know, one thing I want you to do with that email is before these breakout calls, if you're going to be on it with me, send me a list of questions or a list of things you'd like to hear talked about. I find that a good way to get some things going. But also it'll be a way of, you know, if I mention a reading or I mention a theorist in passing and you catch it, send me an email and I might be able to follow up with some readings or some hints or something if it's easy. Too much of a strain. So great.
Zach,
so that's,
sorry.
Please, go ahead.
I'm very interested in this whole topic of what you've generalized on the table here. And I've sort of, I suppose, in a very individual, singular way, been trying to approach the same topic since the 70s myself. And I've written a thesis in 1999 that was called Landscapes in Primordial Space, Resonance and Patterns of a Forgotten Language, trying to bridge or connect, if you like, different faculties of academic thinking into a more unified approach and understanding, especially directed towards development and learning or consciousness. That's where I've come from, and I'm not overly learned in that I haven't been able to remain in academia land, and I've also wanted to do a PhD and travel the circles down here in Tasmania many times, knocking on doors, but found that there wasn't the right medium of supervision or interest, if you like, in such an esoterically based, or it's not really esoteric to those who understand a bit more, but for them it was far more esoterically based than what anyone was really interested in at the time. So my fascination's been long term, and I'm very interested in this whole aspect of unified language. And in actual fact, that was the one criticism I got back from one of my literary professors who I have great admiration for, but he missed the plot in terms of how I was presenting that concept and thought that I meant to destroy diversity by having a unified perception, if you like, or language base from which we operate. But he didn't understand that, I don't think. But I'm on the same storyline, if you like.
It's worth kind of riffing off of that, because I think, you know, as far as the second simplicity kind of broad structure that we're holding here, you know, there have been attempts to kind of forge one language out of the many languages of the academy before. So, for example, the basic thrust of analytical philosophy in post-war America, the Vienna Circle, right, who migrated to the United States, the logical empiricists, right? They had a plan for a unified, an encyclopedia of the unified sciences, right? And so they were actually looking to do that, but here's the catch, right? It was a kind of first simplicity. They wanted to say, you know, there's all this diversity of, there's all these social sciences, and there's all this psychological stuff, and there's all this emotional language, and none of that's actually real language. What's real language, right? What's the real one language is the language of the hard sciences. So let's find a way to translate those, the cacophony of voices, translate it into a single tongue, right? And that's a different way of forging a unified language. And so when some people hear the kind of Wilberian hubris, as it were, to unify all the disciplines, they think, this is just some imperialist kind of modernist way of kind of squelching the diversity of language games in the academy. But the truth is, it's not that way of forging a single language, right? And that's this trick with moving from simplicity, right, to a complexity. And then what's that simplicity on the other side of complexity, where it's a unified language, and yet it doesn't kind of squelch that diversity? And I think to do that, you need to build orienting generalizations the way Wilber has, and you need to frame things in extremely abstract normative terms. So we can talk more about, you know, the way he has done that meta-theorizing, and the way I think, you know, and there's different arguments. Some people think that Wilber has, in a way, squelch some diversity and kind of tone down some of the debates and disagreements that surround his most basic constructs. So that's interesting. And the other kind of that's one point, which is that there have been attempts before to weave a single language out of the diversity of the academy, and not all of them have been as complex and as coherent as the Wilberian project. But the other point is that this stuff isn't really what's happening in the academy right now, per se. The academy itself is increasingly fragmented. Now, there's a reaction. There's a reaction, and what I mean by that is that, you know, a new journal is founded every day. Right? Departments, which used to be big coherent silos, have now become silos within silos within silos. Right? And so, in a way, it's good. In a way, it's what you would expect. Where you have these kind of clusters of new disciplines arising around advances in technology, for example. When the fMRI scanner became affordable so that every hospital could have one, you had a cluster of neuroscientific disciplines emerge around that technological advance. You have different clusters of disciplines emerging around government funding, and so the academy is just kind of sprawling and evolving. And you have some reactions where you have some interdisciplinary programs, some kind of problem-oriented programs, some, you know, a new thrust on general education for undergraduates and those kinds of things to try to, you know, weave a coherent picture for these kids who are just overwhelmed by information in the, you know. So, but, you know, on the whole, the move isn't towards a unifying account or a unifying transdisciplinary approach in the academy. So that's, in a way, why I get on calls like this, because you can't speak in overarching terms a lot of the time, even when it's appropriate. So for, you know, when I've done my work in around the ethics of psychopharmacology in educational contexts, right, which is, I think, an extremely relevant and important issue, it was hard for me to get in the door with a commitment to a biopsychosocial approach, right, which is the way I was integrally. I was saying we want a comprehensive approach, right, an approach of comprehensive care, which means you include biological, psychological, sociocultural factors. And it was tough, you know, because the brain scientists wanted basically just the neuroscientific part. And then the educationists, you know, God bless them, didn't want to hear anything about biology of the brain because that's just eugenics. And so it's tough. It's tough. And so it's, in a way, so yeah, people like Wilbur, but there are others like Habermas and, you know, they're kind of voices in the in the wilderness in an academy that is flourishing and evolving, but not kind of concerned about being coherent. You know, there's not it. So anyway, so that's kind of me riffing off of yours. So let's have somebody else. Is there anybody else who's got some questions or topics to bring up on this first call?
Well, if no one else is jumping in, this is John again, but I'd be happy to let anyone else talk who hasn't and wants to. Doesn't seem that way. I just, you know, I'm struck by listening to your description of the academic world, and it basically, you know, it really boils down to a pretty standard, almost impenetrable wall that academia really, you know, ignores in many ways what we, you know, what you would call the interior subjective. And, right, for me, that's kind of where my heart is in education, is in the interior objective. I mean, you know, obviously not to the point of imbalance, but we live in a world where the interior objective is so ignored that the shift needs to be much further in that direction, almost, you know, radically in the direction of interior subjective, you know, which we see in the larger world, but really not much in academia. I mean, a little bit, you know, I know, you know, there's, here in Massachusetts, we have things like the, you know, the, what do they call it, the mindfulness-based stress reduction programs that are kind of integrated into the academic world, but it's, you know, it's small. But it seems to me like that's sort of, you know, that's almost like a bang your head against the wall sort of proposition, you know, trying, in some ways, taking you know, the descriptive and linguistic way to explaining these things is really almost insufficient to people who don't explore that landscape of the interior subjective. I guess, I don't know if I have a question so much. I guess I'm kind of curious, you know, more about your experience of that, because I sort of, you know, I kind of dropped out of academia myself, mostly for those reasons. You know, I guess I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on that and how that's going and how, you know, how you find the actual, because it's an experience-based system. It's not, you know, for people to develop to ways where they can comprehend this sort of stuff, they have to explore themselves on many different levels. And I'm a teacher who, you know, puts my whole, really wraps most of my work up in that, more into that realm of interior subjective, and I find it excruciatingly satisfying. I don't know. I'm just curious if you have, you know, how that's going and what, if, you know, more, if you can speak more about that or if you want to.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, point taken. I mean, I think it is tough going to get certain types of enterprises underway on a large scale. I mean, the good news is that like I said, it's not a homogenization. So it's not like everything's moving towards some direction or some reductionistic stance. You're getting a lot of flowers blooming in a lot of different places. So there's kind of multitudinous endeavors, especially in education. I think for me, the difficulty with the emphasis on the interiorities and getting a foot in the door on that stuff is that people always talk about meditation, right? And people always kind of try to bring in these approaches which have a lot of kind of baggage from the kind of spiritual marketplace in which they were, you know, first.
Yeah, there's sort of a lot of religious sentimentality
right.
around a lot of it.
There's the religiosity, but I think it's also it's a truncating of the interiority. Like I think of what students need, especially college kids, high school kids, is not experience on the mat meditating. I think they need to have a coherent, action-orienting self-understanding, right? And and values that aren't a result of the superficial media culture. And, you know, all of that stuff is interiority. And it's not about getting kids to meditate, but it's about, for example, it's about weaving this new narrative about what is the nature of this society and how do we orient as human beings and relating to one another. And so those are the discourses I want to see in schools. And there's some push in that direction, but again, some of the work I'm doing in standardized testing, I'm characterizing this contrast between efficiency in education and fairness in education. And I think because our system is so big and because we're struggling in so many ways with such diverse populations, it's radically changing economy, there's been this emphasis on efficiency, you know. But as a result, we've neglected the experience of the student, right, as you're saying. And that's,
well, and it, as you, excuse me, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying that. Unfair, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, the other thing is the motivation of educational systems. You know, if the motivation of education, you know, as people use this term, we lack a grand narrative. You know, we lack a unifying narrative, which gives us purpose and reason. And so, if you really look at the purpose and reason behind the educational system, it's very institutionalized. You know, sort of creating humanoid cogs of a machine process, and so it really there's no reason to delve into there.
In some ways. Right. And again, this is the second simplicity thing. And you know, we're New Englanders, so I can be grumpy, and it's been a hard winter.
Yeah.
But my point would be basically, you know, that's just kind of, yeah, you know, there is a big kind of technocratic element to American public education. And you can't ignore the fact that the government has instrumentalized the educational system to produce certain types of citizens. Did that. They threw money in certain directions and not other directions.
And not necessarily consciously, you know, though some people like to believe it's all very conscientious, all of the ways in which we've created the system, but, you know.
Right, no, but my point is more that, so there was that motivation, and I would say that that's this kind of principled motivation towards, you know, efficiency, both in terms of the economy and in terms of our foreign policy, especially during the Cold War with a big kind of national educational reforms, you know, the war on poverty and that kind of stuff. But the other side of it, the other to complexify it, to not just tell a simple story about the citizens being and kind of economic determinism, but to tell it more complicated. So there was also a thrust, which is represented by people like Dewey, people like Kremen, and even Jefferson. There was a thrust where education is actually this radically liberational enterprise, and that, you know, the goal of the American educational system is to create a fluid, classless society where fairness is the most important thing, and not the pursuit of happiness, but the pursuit of, you know, dignity and mutual respect and a variety of things that can only be fostered through educational means. And there was always that discourse as well.
Yeah.
And so that's, to me, the hard part about, and again, it's, you know, how do you hold both of those? How do you admit that, okay, in a way, this system, this massive educational system, is the result of some, you know, powerful white military industrial complex style decisions. But at the same time, it's also the result of this, you know, lineage of people who are deeply concerned about social justice and about the liberation of human potential and about the pursuit of, you know, freedom and good stuff. And both of those give us the system. And so that's just an example of, you know, I think to see just one or the other is to have that kind of simplicity. All the educational systems been great. And America's the best in the world, and or it's just bad. But they somehow tell a story that weaves both the good and the bad together at a higher level. That's an example of the second simplicity. And actually, as a cognitive operation, it's an example of post-formal operational thinking, where you have two fully elaborate systems of ideas, which you then bring together in terms of an overarching construct or generalization or principle, right?
Yeah, and, you know, in a way, we see it this time. It's like, you know, we're witnessing, quote-unquote, the battle between good and evil in some ways. You know, I mean, it is even just from day-to-day experience from, you know, my local public elementary schools. They have so much heart and so much great intention and so many wonderful teachers. And, you know, the principal of the school will shrug her shoulders and say, I know exactly what you're talking about, and here's where my hands are tied, you know, just sort of existing in the institutionalized framework makes all of that stuff, you know, that's happening, not that it isn't happening to some degree, but it creates a very stifling environment for that to grow in.
Right, no, and that's, I think, you know, that's the other, or one of the other kind of motives for this type of educational thing here on the phone, right, which is that, you know, how do we find ways to bring this stuff into these structures as they exist? And, you know, you can't, what's the saying about social change, you know, you can't rebuild your boat at sea. You have to kind of rebuild it piece by piece. Like too late at night here in Massachusetts to recall the exact phrasing there.
I don't know. I get your drift.
Yeah, right. And so, and again, I mentioned this phrase before, to make integral moves in non-integral language games, right? It's not to sell out and to say, oh, we can't change the system, so we have to work in the system. But it's saying, actually, you know, social change is what systems theorists call path-dependent, right? Which means that there is tracks laid down. So think about, for example, the changeover to different forms of energy, right? One of the main reasons it's so difficult is because you can't scrap the entire prior infrastructure, right? The reason ethanol is so appealing is because we'll still have gas stations and highways and these kinds of things. And there are comparable path-dependent kind of prior track-dependent aspects to cultural change and social evolution. So it's not so much about accepting the system as it is finding those leverage points, right? So that's, and I think there's a lot of ammunition, as it were, in integral theory that is actually really, really good at that. And I think, you know, once you've moved past the kind of all you can talk in the spiral dynamics language phase and towards a phase of using integral theory where actually can speak to people, you know, it becomes a much more powerful tool. And I'll put here, and I'm talking about people transforming in their engagement with integral theory. I think, and this is something I've actually studied, so I meant to say this when I introduced myself, but I forgot. I work with Sean Hargens at John F. Kennedy University Integral Research Center. We're actually doing a pretty large-scale research study on the way master's students in the integral theory program change over the course of the program, specifically in the way they think about integral theory itself. So we're actually building what we call learning sequences in the way people understand integral theory. That's pretty fascinating, you know. And so, for example, this is relevant to what I've been saying about moving beyond simple ways of grasping integral constructs. We find, for example, people first start using developmental level mostly by just using the spiral dynamics color language, and the colors essentially serve as stereotypes for kind of making broad brushstrokes generalizations about cultural groups or about individuals. So that's kind of the first understanding. And then people all of a sudden will be the transformation. The story gets more complicated. And now they see that there's actually a variety of developmental models. And they can switch speaking. They can speak the spiral dynamics language, but then they can also bring in Kohlberg's language, or they can bring in Suzanne Kogreuter's language, and they're kind of playing with multiple models. And then people actually start to reflect on where the models themselves came from, right? Well, how come there are so many models? Why isn't there just one model? How were the different models built? What are the different methods that are involved? And slowly the simple story about levels of stereotypes becomes this increasingly complex, increasingly reflective, especially reflective on issues of ideology. And then the highest levels, you find people actually move beyond a kind of agnosticism to multiple models and a kind of, methodological sophistication, and so much so that you're making caveats about every claim you make. And they move beyond that, and now they're actually using the sophisticated models they have to speak in simple ways and to offer simple suggestions, for example, in education. Right.
So that's kind of my assumption, though, about that integral education. You're studying people who are probably being schooled in a way that is much more, holistic or integral or whatever term you want. They're having experiences in all of the quadrants that are affecting their growth, which is, maybe the thing that's missing from other people and other educational systems developing that way is approaching it primarily cognitively. And there's only so far you can go that way.
Yeah, no, it could be. I mean, this is a unique program for sure.
Yeah.
Like I said, we're studying just simply the way the concepts of integral theory themselves evolve and change while they learn it, while they learn about them. And so we're also measuring other aspects of student development there. So, for example, the development of the way they structure their thinking about themselves in relationships, how does that change as a result of getting more sophisticated in your thinking about integral theory or something like that. So it's an interesting research project, but it's part of the context for these calls also is my growing understanding about how people grapple with this content, how people grapple with Wilbur's ideas and the kind of constellation of comparable theorists. It's interesting to me. But there is this movement. There is this movement from a simple getting it and loving it and seeing the whole world in terms of it to pushing through that, really questioning it, really actually looking and reading into the bibliographies and footnotes and then kind of re-embracing it, right? Finding a kind of more nuanced and yet still simple way of using the theoretical constructs. So, all right, so we're running down on time here, so let's take a couple more questions, and then I want to, wrap it up and make sure we're on the same page so that the next call we can hit the ground running and kind of really do some give and take. So anybody else got some lingering thoughts here or ideas on is the frame clear that I'm offering, and are we sure kind of what we want to do moving forward?
Yeah, so is there anyone else out there? I think there might just be John and myself.
I'm here.
All right.
Hi, this is Fabio.
Hello, Fabio.
Can you hear me? Okay. I'm very interested about what you're saying, all of you, and it seems like you guys know a lot about the integral theory. I have to confess that I don't know a lot about this, but I was wondering when you were talking, how or what integral theory would say about the current events in the Middle East and in Northern Africa, in Egypt, in Libya, etc. Is the planetary consciousness speeding up? What's happening? So how can we use integral theory to understand the current events?
Right. I mean, that's obviously a huge question.
Yeah, I know.
And I think, that's probably a question that we are going to want to continually revisit over the course of these calls.
Of course. Yeah.
Because I think, you can already look in the, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe the integral blogosphere or something. Anyway, there's a bunch of integral writers out there on the web, and many of them have already taken stabs at characterizing the situation in the Middle East, in the Arab world, and I guess in other parts of the world too. The economic crisis is, for example, there are labor disputes in the United States right now, which hasn't happened in a while. So people have already taken a stab at it. One thing we could do in these calls is look at the way people have used integral theory to characterize the situation in the Middle East and see what we think of it. I think what you'll find is that there are accounts at varying levels of complexity, right? I think, for example, I've read some stuff coming out of this Power Dynamics camp where they're talking about this in terms of clashes between different developmental levels, right? So you have the kind of green or egalitarian or pluralistic postmodern Egyptian youth tapped into social networking, educated at American University, instilled with American ideals. Somehow they get organized with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the quote-unquote blue meme, kind of very organized, you know, down there. And they're pushing against the kind of orange, modernistic, you know, imperialistic, you know, dictatorship. And it's a coherent story, and it's spiced up by the fact that there's kind of a developmental model implicit in it, but it reads in a kind of a simple way, right? So, for example, notice the way it supervenes on Egyptian history, right? What do we know about the history of the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization, for example? What deeply complexify its simple characterization as blue meme, right? What do we know about all the Egyptian youth who left Egypt after getting educated and said, no, I'm not going back, right? So there's a bunch of subplots, which I think sometimes the shot from the hip integral vocabulary can actually, you know, lead us to ignore some of the details because we're so happy with the generalizations. So those are just some initial thoughts because, frankly, I haven't gotten to the second sympathy around the issues in the Middle East. I'm still in the overwhelmed by complexity phase of thinking about it.
Right.
You know, and just seeing the full kind of world historical significance potentially of these pushes, these kind of thrusts towards what could be a much more democratic, I mean, if you're optimistic, a much more democratic geopolitical you know, climate in that area. So that would be, so yeah, so anyway, so I want to kind of table that and say, let's, maybe that's something that we want to continually bring up, right? So for example, if we start to look at some of Wilbur's constructs around sociocultural development, look at them in terms of Habermas, look at them in terms of Gebser and say William Irwin Thompson, and then get a deeper understanding of how those cultural dynamics move, and then maybe we can look at it again, wrap some different language around it. Certainly a relevant topic, certainly amenable, and in need of a kind of a coherent meta-narrative. You know, I think it's also, for me, it's an issue of, you know, is it ours to impose that? Like, where is that going to emerge from amongst the participants themselves? You know, because I think it's one of the driving questions behind this kind of disruptive social media is, will this ever be more than disruptive social media? Is this type of social networking, for example, are you able to weave coherent narratives that combine groups of people together? Or is it by its very nature kind of this fragmented, you know, isolating, disruptive technology? So anyway, so I'm just riffing here. So I'm gonna kind of draw this to a close with just a few kind of requests moving forward. So if you're on the call tonight, please email me just so I have a sense of who was on the call. Let me know how it went. Give me some feedback. And give me a set of ideas about what maybe we'll talk about next time. Like I said, it could either be some Wilberian constructs that we want to run the second simplicity dialectic on, move past simple understanding towards all the complexity and caveats and re-articulate simply again, or it could be, as this example of the Middle East crisis, kind of a macro level issue that we want to think through together. So do that. So again, the email is stein.zak@gmail.com. You know, we'll see where it goes. So I'm excited, and I'll say, you know, this is I used to live in Northampton, Massachusetts, and we had this Wilbur group that would meet on Friday nights from like 5 p.m. to almost like 11 or midnight, and we would just talk, and everything would come up, and it was I think the way philosophy should be, which is discourse and debate about stuff that actually informs who you are and the way you see the world. So my hope is that we can kind of slowly cook together and kind of build a container and hopefully some fun stuff here on these calls. Does that sound good to people, everyone?
Great.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach.
Thanks. I look forward to your emails.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Good night.